Officials in the U.S. and other countries, as well as Taliban commanders and their sympathizers, have now had 3 days to go through the thousands of intelligence reports published this week by the group WikiLeaks. At the Pentagon today, an angry Defense Secretary Robert Gates said the leak has done severe damage and announced his department would aggressively investigate to determine how it happened. NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
Secretary Gates had not spoken on the leak before, but on the Pentagon podium today, he did not mince words in describing the effect of WikiLeaks publishing tens of thousands of secret intelligence reports from the Afghan war.
The battlefield consequences of the release of these documents are potentially severe and dangerous for our troops, our allies, and Afghan partners, and may well damage our relationships and reputation in that key part of the world.
The immediate concern has been those Afghans whose lives could be in danger if it's known they worked with U.S. and NATO forces. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has claimed that he and his colleagues took care not to reveal those identities, but many were exposed, as Afghan President Hamid Karzai pointed out today in Kabul.
Names of such Afghans who have cooperated with the coalition NATO have been also revealed in these documents. This indeed is extremely irresponsible and shocking.
In a TV interview this week, Assange acknowledged that some identities, in fact, may accidentally have been revealed. But he said the people killed in Afghanistan by U.S. and NATO forces is, quote, a bigger problem, unquote. Assange has said his intent in publishing the secret documents was to affect the political will to change the course of war. At the Pentagon today, Admiral Mike Mullen, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was withering in his response.
Mr. Assange can say whatever he likes about the greater good he thinks he and his source are doing, but the truth is they might already have on their hands the blood of some young soldier or that of an Afghan family.
Going forward, the U.S. concern is that the publication of classified information may make individuals and governments less likely to cooperate with U.S. and allied forces in the future. Defense Secretary Gates, a former CIA director, says the sacrosanct principle in the intelligence world is trust.
That is one of the worst aspects of this, as far as I'm concerned. Will people trust us? Will people whose lives are on the line trust us to keep their identities secret? Will other governments trust us to keep their documents and their intelligence secret?
Intelligence officials often speak of the importance of protecting not only sources, but also methods. Many of the documents released by WikiLeaks are so-called incident reports and describe in some detail operations that have taken place on the battlefield. Retired Marine Major General Michael Ennis, a former director of human intelligence at the Defense Intelligence Agency, says his concern as an intelligence professional would be that the field reports may include details the enemy could learn from.
If it was revealed how a special operations team happened to come on a particular enemy post or position using a tradecraft method of getting to that place or getting certain information, that's what I'm talking about. Methods used of getting the information or methods used for finding the bad guys.
American soldiers, of course, can also learn from the methods of fellow soldiers. At the Pentagon, Gates says the handling of secret field reports will be reconsidered now with the goal of finding a balance between the benefit of sharing intelligence information and keeping it secure.
Should we change the way we approach that? Or do we continue to take the risk?
The reports published by WikiLeaks are believed to have come from a low-level Army analyst stationed in Baghdad. Defense Secretary Gates says he's asked the FBI to help the Pentagon aggressively investigate this leak wherever it leads, and he says they will prosecute any violations of security wherever possible. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Microsoft is pulling the plug today on a program that essentially paid people to use its Bing search engine. NPR's Asma Khalid tells us why the program didn't stick.
More than 1,000 companies took part in the Bing Cashback program. The way it worked was if shoppers went through Bing to the merchant sites and then bought things, they'd receive a portion of the money back, sometimes up to 30%.
I've purchased like my contact lenses through them, various electronics purchases, and my savings have totaled in cash back over $1,000 through Bing.
Greg Russell is an IT manager in Las Vegas and one of the many online bargain hunters who took advantage of the program. The idea was aimed at attracting new users to Microsoft's search engine, but it may not have worked out that way. Tushar Bajaj from Texas is another online shopper who loved Bing Cashback.
If I don't have an incentive to use Bing anymore with this program being taken away, then I would rather just go back to Google.
The problem for Microsoft is we're creatures of habit. Ina Fried is a senior writer for CNET.
Even with me, they face the same hurdle they face with other people, which is by the time I even think which search engine am I going to use, I've already typed G-O-O-G. So, I mean, that's the behavior, the sort of hardwired behavior that Microsoft has to have us all unlearn if Bing's going to be successful.
Microsoft would not say how many people used the program or how much money was paid out. The company only stated, quote, "We did not see the broad adoption we had hoped for," end quote. But Bing is gaining followers. It's gained a few points in market share. According to the online data research firm Experian Hitwise, Bing almost has 10% of the search market. By comparison, Google has 71%. Asma Khalid, NPR News.
A controversial Army Experience Center in a northeast Philadelphia shopping mall closed yesterday after a two-year pilot program. As Windsor Johnston of member station WRTI reports, the Army declared its outreach efforts at the multi-million dollar facility a mission accomplished.
Using screen names such as Warlord and Number One Shooter, teenage boys sit in a row of Army green recliners facing flat-screen monitors, challenging each other in video games of war.
See, he really, really going to try to kill me, too. I don't know where he is.
19-year-old Kevin Houston and 18-year-old Damian King square off in the popular Call of Duty game, Modern Warfare.
No, that was you I hit, wasn't it?
Once visitors register and prove that they are 13 years or older, they're given free access to the facility's array of war-themed games. Army Experience Center spokesman Captain John Kirchkessner says the center has proven more effective than traditional recruiting methods.
By use of technology and by way of basically creating a relationship with the community is a much better way to share our Army story than to simply smile and dial and ask somebody if they've thought about joining lately.
The facility also houses three simulators, including an Apache and Black Hawk helicopter and an armored combat Humvee. 18-year-old John Galato and three of his 15-year-old friends sit atop the Army vehicle with a lifelike machine gun in hand. Galato says experience like this will help prepare him for the future.
I'm going to be killing people. So I'm actually joining the Marines, so I'll be doing this in real life one day soon.
When given the green light, the four teens begin maneuvering through virtual war zones, shooting at targets while dodging bullets themselves. But these simulated war experiences have been met with strong opposition. Combat veteran Staff Sergeant Jesse Hamilton says the Army has sanitized the horrors of combat.
People screaming, blood, flies, horrible smells, the list goes on and on. And they've taken all of that out, and what they've effectively left is the portion which they consider to be the fun part.
Captain Kirchkessner says recruits are well aware of the dangers of combat.
If you were to ask any one of them, do you feel as though the Army is going to be like playing with a controller or a game? They're going to say absolutely not. You know, that's crazy to even think that.
Five nearby recruiting offices were closed when the Philadelphia Center opened in 2008. Since then, an estimated 240 recruits have enlisted at the Army Experience Center. While overall recruitment rates in the area have stayed the same, Kirchkessner says the facility reached that number with half the staff. This fall, two new Army Opportunity Centers will open in the Philadelphia region, downscaled versions of the Experience Center. For NPR News, I'm Windsor Johnston in Philadelphia.
This is NPR News.
And now we go to Back Talk. It's the segment that lifts the curtain on what's happening in the Tell Me More blogosphere and where listeners get to talk back. Lee Hill, the program's digital media guy, is here with me. Hey, Lee. What are people saying this week?
Hey, Rebecca. Well, first of all, welcome to Back Talk.
Thank you.
And this week we talked about the split among African Americans in California over Proposition 19, and that would allow adults 21 and over to possess up to an ounce of marijuana. Some agree with the measure, citing research that shows blacks are far more likely to suffer criminal consequences for illegal drug use than whites. Others argue that marijuana is a gateway drug and that legalizing it will only lead to more aggressive drug abuse. Here's a clip from our Tell Me More conversation this week with Pastor Ron Allen. He's bishop of what he calls the International Faith-Based Coalition in California.
Not only are blacks arrested for marijuana, when we take a look at crack cocaine and other crimes that are committed in the black neighborhood, we can see the disparities of arrest there also. Yes, we do need to talk and have a dialogue why blacks are being arrested and Latinos more than anyone else.
Regarding arrests, we received a post to our online forum from blogger Donna. I caught up with her, and here is what she had to say.
Perhaps the reason more blacks are arrested for marijuana possession than whites is that more blacks live in urban areas where there are more cops. I live in a very rural area where we have no police and depend on state troopers an hour away in the event of an emergency. However, almost my entire neighborhood would be locked up for marijuana possession if we were all placed in an urban setting. I don't think this is a black-white issue as much as it is a matter of geography.
So, Lee, we also have a few updates to some past Tell Me More stories. Last week, the program reported on a situation brewing in Utah where a list containing very personal information about 1,300 allegedly illegal immigrants was sent to the media and to law enforcement agencies. The sender demanded that everyone on it be deported. We've since learned that two state employees responsible for the list have been fired. And Lee, we should also mention that state officials have found that some of those who were on that list were actually in the U.S. legally.
And Rebecca, there's also been an update in the case of Sean Bell. He's the 23-year-old man who was unarmed but killed when New York City police fired 50 shots into his car back in 2006 on what would have been his wedding day. Now, three of the officers involved were acquitted of manslaughter and reckless endangerment charges. And you might remember the case sparked quite a fury far outside of New York. And this week we learned the city agreed to pay more than $7 million to settle a federal lawsuit filed by Bell's family and by two friends who were with him that night who were also shot and injured.
There's also one other update, Lee. A few months ago, Michelle spoke with Jeremy Lin. He is the only Asian American on the basketball team at Harvard University. Well, now he's actually made a huge leap. He's becoming the first Taiwanese American playing for the NBA. Mr. Lin has signed with the Golden State Warriors in Oakland, so we may be seeing him as a point guard. Thank you so much, Lee.
Thank you, Rebecca.
And remember, with Tell Me More, the conversation never ends. You can call the comment line at 202-842-3522. Remember to leave your name, please. You can also log on to the website. Go to npr.org, click on Programs, and then on Tell Me More, and blog it out.
Now, a new kind of medical technology that can transmit your physiological information to your doctor from just about anywhere. Think of it as a really smart Band-Aid. There's just one problem. It's so new that regulators are still figuring out what rules are necessary to protect the public. Colorado Public Radio's Eric Whitney reports.
A wirelessly enabled Band-Aid that can call your doctor when it detects a problem is still a very cutting-edge technology. But it builds on more than a decade of refining the practice of remote monitoring. That's when healthcare providers give patients simple-to-use home diagnostic equipment that connects to a network.
Hook it up.
Like the smart blood pressure cuff Natalie Cole uses in Golden, Colorado.
Hit the start button, and it'll run through its cycle. It's all automatic. I don't have to do anything but sit here.
The cuff inflates, takes a reading, and then, through her home computer, uploads the numbers to a secure website.
See if I remember my password on it.
The important part is that Cole can quickly and easily share her blood pressure numbers with doctors and pharmacists. The system has already helped them adjust her medication.
Because it wasn't quite where they wanted it. So they changed my prescription at that point.
Stories like that have convinced Cole's HMO, Kaiser Permanente Colorado, that networking smart medical devices in the home can improve care and save money. The Department of Veterans Affairs has been saying that for years. A recent VA study of 17,000 patients found remote monitoring cut hospitalizations by 19%. And remote monitoring is poised to become a lot more common thanks to a new generation of tiny sensors that can be worn by a patient 24/7. worn on an adhesive strip that sticks to the skin about the size of a large Band-Aid.
Band-Aids now we know can measure the electrocardiogram, the heart rhythm, respiratory rate, the temperature of the patient.
That's Dr. Eric Topol with the West Wireless Institute, an industry group that promotes wireless medical devices. He says smart Band-Aids can measure dozens of health indicators and then display readings on a patient's mobile phone or even the internet.
It's basically what we would call the body area network, where it involves a sensor, and today usually Bluetooth to get that to a transmitter and then sent off to the web.
Getting the information on the web enables all kinds of potential applications. One that's in the works is aimed at the problem physicians call noncompliance, better known as, Mom, did you take your pills? Dr. George Savage's startup company is developing tiny microchips that can be embedded in pills.
What we've managed to do is create a tiny grain of sand-sized integrated circuit, which is coated with essential minerals. And when swallowed, those different minerals generate a small amount of power, a little voltage.
That voltage can be detected on the skin by, you guessed it, a smart Band-Aid. It could literally text Savage, confirming his mother actually swallowed her pills. That kind of technology scares some people, and there's concern that it's all getting ahead of public safety. Federal regulators are still wrestling with who's responsible for approving the new generation of mobile health devices.
There is a little bit of a gray area, and that's part of the reason why we're stepping up our collaboration.
Julius Knapp is with the Federal Communications Commission. It's collaborating with the Food and Drug Administration to write new rules for the wireless medical industry. That's slowing the release of some products for which there's already demand. But Knapp says that delay is okay.
Where we need to make sure that there is reliable operation is where we may, for example, be monitoring critical life-sustaining functions or perhaps even controlling remotely treatment.
An example would be a wirelessly controlled insulin pump for diabetics. It could release exactly the right amount of insulin to keep someone healthy, based on readings sent to it by a smart Band-Aid. But if there's radio interference or some other glitch with either the patch or the pump, there could be serious health consequences. Knapp says the agencies want to open the door to the promise of the new technology, but only if it doesn't jeopardize people's lives. For NPR News, I'm Eric Whitney in Denver. This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
One day, not long ago, Greg Storm DiCostanzo was listening to his local public radio station to coverage of the WikiLeaks story. Now, when we at All Things Considered first heard about the latest round of documents released by WikiLeaks, we thought about the national security implications and about what sort of story these documents tell about the war in Afghanistan. Well, not DiCostanzo. Every time he heard about WikiLeaks, he thought about WikiLeaks. That's right, as in Chewbacca from the Star Wars movies. Greg DiCostanzo joins me now to explain to our listeners what exactly is a WikiLeak. So, Greg, or I guess I should call you Storm, please tell
us.
What's the answer to that question? What exactly is a WikiLeak?
A WikiLeak is a Twitter hashtag game. And a hashtag is something where you can place a hash mark, a number symbol, in front of a word like, say, WikiLeaks, to create a searchable code word that anyone interested in that subject can very quickly look up. So if you have this code word, you can create games, usually revolving around puns. It seemed to me like it would make a terrific Twitter game to come up with these ideas about, okay, what if instead of from the war in Afghanistan, there were leaks coming out of the Star Wars universe? And so I devised this first tweet. Testimony in some of the papers indicate that Chewbacca used mind-altering drugs while on Endor. Salacious.
Can you do me a favor? Can you share with me some of your favorite posts? Just read through a few of them.
Sure. From Turk's Head, insurgents targeted by Imperial stormtroopers revealed to be cute fuzzy Ewoks. from Dowdig, protocol droid fluent in 6 million languages, discharged for violating Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
What is it about Star Wars that inspires such, you could say geekiness, or perhaps you could say passion?
Mm-hmm. I think there were so many people who grew up with it as I did. I was 7 or 8 years old when I first saw it. And I think it's one of those rare shared experiences anymore that cuts across so many different types of people. And the characters are terrific.
Storm, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
That's Greg Storm DiConstanzo. He created WookieLeaks. He's also half of the comedy duo Paul and Storm.
And one final note. Today we say goodbye to a true Jedi Master, Chelsea Jones.
She's been a key part of our team of ace bookers, working the phones, lining up the guests you hear on the program, including countless lawmakers, artists, and experts on everything from medicine to message decoding to the official World Cup ball.
However impossible the assignment, Chelsea got the job done with grace and with good humor, qualities she'll take with her to law school this fall.
Chelsea, we are going to miss you. May the Force be with you.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News.